All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Guiding Light. This is officially a time when I do go through a book with you. It's called Inspired Book Study with Regina Dawn Akers. And in case you don't know, last week we started a new book, and actually it's 2 to 3 books. It's really, I'm going to call it an author for now since this is a book study. We're really looking at Bernadette Roberts, and I'm going to be using 2 or 3 of her books. As far as I know, who knows, maybe we'll go to more to get a good look at what she's sharing with us. Last week, I began the introduction in the book called The Experience of No Self. Tonight, I'll do a brief review of what we looked at last week. And then if we get to it, I will also look at the introduction in What is Self. But I'm going to jump right in because, as mentioned, we only have 30 minutes, and this is important, important stuff. So starting with the review, I'm just going to read a little bit that we covered last week from the introduction. Again, Bernadette Roberts is who I'm reading. She was a Catholic contemplative. She says, though my contemplative experiences began at an early age, and in fact, I'm reading her autobiography, her contemplative experiences began at age 2. All right, so when she says early age, she means early age. Though my contemplative experiences began at an early age, listen to this next sentence. It was not until I was 15 that I discovered how these experiences fit, like the inset of a child's puzzle, into the larger framework of the Christian contemplative tradition. This finding was followed by 10 years of relative seclusion. So beginning at age 15, she went into 10 years of seclusion in order to pursue the Christian goal of union with God. And once I had the certitude of this goal's realization, so by the time she was absolutely certain that she had reached the unitive state, which we would call awakening to consciousness, she says, once I had the certitude of this goal's realization, I entered the more ordinary stream of life where I remain to this day. And what she actually did was she became a Carmelite nun, which allowed her to be in seclusion. She wasn't as interested in the Catholic religion as she was in reaching union with God. And she saw being a Carmelite nun as a path that would allow her to do that. Once she awoke to consciousness or reached union with God and was absolutely certain that she had, she left. She was no longer a nun. In fact, she went on to have, I guess, get married. I haven't seen her write that yet, but I assume get married and have 4 children. She says, within the traditional framework, the Christian notion of loss of self is generally regarded as the transformation or loss of the ego, or what sometimes is called the lower self, as it attains to the higher or the true self in its union with God. So again, what happened to her in that 10 years of seclusion between the ages of 15 and 25 is that the ego died. She lost the ego. She awoke to consciousness. She felt certain she had attained the goal she had set out to attain, and she left the nunhood. I don't know what you call that. She left the nunhood and became a regular person on the street. She says, thus, being lost to myself meant, at the same time, being found in God as a sharer of divine life. From here on, the deepest sense of being and life is equally the sense of God being and life. And again, she's using the word God. She uses Catholic terminology. We might often use the word consciousness. So she's saying there was no difference. Now that the ego had died, there was no difference between her and consciousness. It's kind of like what Jesus said, I and the Father are one, right? This was her complete experience at this point. She says, thus, because self at its deepest center is a run-on with the divine, I never found any true self apart from God, for to find the one is to find the other. Again, she experienced complete unionhood with God or consciousness. And this was all that she really expected. That was the only goal she had set. That's why she went into seclusion. And so she goes on to say, because this was the limit of my expectations, I was all the more surprised and bewildered when many years later, I came upon a permanent state in which there was no self, no higher self, no true self, or anything that could be called a self. And this is what we call awakening to the absolute or the first principle of God. So again, using the language of the models of the fourth principle of God, of the four principles of God, first she awoke from the fourth principle to the second principle of God, didn't even know there was another awakening, just continued to follow her height, her heart and her guidance, and later awakened surprisingly to this first principle of God, which she knew nothing about. She says, I am convinced that the contemplative life is composed of two distinct and separate movements, and those would be the two awakenings. And so that kind of reviews what we covered last week. So now I'm going into new material. If you're reading along, I'll be doing some reading here. I'm beginning at the bottom of page 12, but also, as you know, I'm also only reading what I underline, so I'll be doing some skipping around. She says, I might add that these intervening years between movements are also largely ignored in contemplative literature. Their importance is highly underestimated due to the failure to realize that this interval is actually the preparation for a great explosion, a quiet one, however, that ushers in another major turning point. So one of the things that she says that in the literature that she has read, and she has read at least Christian and Buddhist literature, Christian mystic and Buddhist literature, that in the literature she has read, people write about awakening to consciousness or about union to God. I have to correct what I just said. Let me start again. In the Christian literature, let me start with just the Christian literature. People write about awakening to consciousness or union with God, but then it stops there. Like, that is the hallmark of awakening. That's all there is. She did mention earlier that in the Buddhist literature, they ignore that phase completely. They don't talk about the first awakening. They only talk about the second awakening to nirvana or to nothingness. And so she couldn't find anywhere in her reading anybody who talked about a first awakening and then another period of transition and then a second awakening. And so she feels this has been ignored, and she thinks the reason it's been ignored is because people do not realize that the purpose of the first awakening and the period of time that follows that is to prepare you for the second or final awakening, and that actually it's the second or final awakening that is the true or genuine awakening. So again, she says, I might add that these intervening years between movements are also largely ignored in contemplative literature. Their importance is highly underestimated due to the failure to realize that this interval is actually the preparation for a great explosion, a quiet one, however, that ushers in another major turning point. A point is reached where the self is so completely aligned with the still point that it can no longer be moved, even in its first movements, from this center. It can no longer be tested by any force or trial, nor moved by the winds of change. I'll stop there. This is still the middle of a sentence, but I will stop there. Last week we read how prior to the first awakening, the focus is internal, on internal purification, on internal realization. After the first awakening, she uses the term external, and she says what the focus is after the first awakening, after you awaken to consciousness, which she calls a still point in the center of the being. She says that there are tests, and I think the word test comes from her Catholic background. I would just say there are circumstances that arise, and that the goal of this second, the goal in the period that follows this first awakening, which we might call a second type of purification, the goal is to remain in that still point, to remain completely as consciousness, completely as the watcher, completely as the observer, regardless of what occurs on the outside, right? So things are happening like life does. And now what you are learning to do is to completely abide in consciousness as consciousness without moving from that point. And if you listen to people who have awakened to consciousness, they talk about this time frame of becoming established. That's the word they often use, established as consciousness, which means learning not to move from that center still point no matter what's occurring in manifestation. And so that's what she talks about. You know, there's this first awakening, which came from an internal focus, and now the focus is more external. Things are happening on the outside, and you are abiding as yourself, regardless of what occurs, abiding as consciousness in this case, regardless of what occurs. Then she says, again, a point is reached where the self is so completely aligned with the still point that it can no longer be moved, even in its first movements from this center. It can no longer be tested by any force or trial, nor moved by the winds of change. So you have learned, you've become established in consciousness. You have learned to abide as consciousness at all times, no matter what. She says, and at this point, the self has obviously outworn its function. It is no longer needed or useful, and life can go on without it. We are ready to move on, to go beyond the self, beyond even its most intimate union with God. And this is where we enter yet another new life, a life best categorized perhaps as a life without a self. And when she says a life without a self, and this will be more carefully explained in what is self, she means a life without consciousness. She's not talking about the ego self. The ego self has already died. She's talking about consciousness as a self. And she says, we come to the point where we don't even need consciousness. The onset of this second movement is characterized by the falling away of self, meaning consciousness in this case, and coming upon that which remains when it is gone. And Ramana Maharshi often talked about, you know, seeking that which remains when everything else is gone. But this going out is an upheaval, a complete turnabout of such proportions it cannot possibly be missed, underemphasized, or sufficiently stressed as a major landmark in the contemplative life. And I love the way she describes the second awakening as a turnabout of such proportions, right? It cannot possibly be missed, underemphasized, or sufficiently stressed. She says the immediate, inevitable result is an emergence into a new dimension of knowing and being that entails a difficult and prolonged readjustment. The brain, I guess, would need to readjust to this. The reflexive mechanism of the mind, or whatever it is that allows us to be self-conscious, is cut off or permanently suspended. So the mind is ever after held in a fixed now moment of which it cannot move its uninterrupted gaze upon the unknown. All right, another long sentence, so let me just break that down in parts again. She says, of course, this second awakening is like awakening to a new dimension of knowing or being. Now, right there, that tells me we can't imagine it, right? It's an entirely new dimension. It's a new dimension of knowing or being. She says the reflexive mechanism of mind, and then she refers to that as whatever it is that allows us to be self-conscious, aware of a self or aware of myself, whether I'm aware of myself as a person or aware of myself as consciousness. She says that is completely destroyed. Right? That is completely destroyed, completely cut off or permanently suspended. And as a result of that being cut off, that ability to be self-conscious, she says the mind then is held in a fixed now moment of which it cannot move its uninterrupted gaze upon the unknown. A now moment where it cannot move its uninterrupted gaze upon the unknown. Right? Now, I have enough experience with true happiness to know that true happiness, permanent happiness, would come from that. Any unhappiness that we experience always comes from us thinking we know something. Every time. You cannot have unhappiness without thinking you know something. Primarily how things should be, how you want things to be, right? But you have to know something. So if you have a permanent, uninterrupted gaze on the unknown, you are also going to be in bliss. Right? The two are automatic. They go together automatically. She goes on to say, okay, you guys ready for this? The few of you that are here, and I really don't expect this teaching to grow. Isn't that funny? I expect this to be the teaching that thins us out. That's okay. Every now and then we need a teaching that thins us out. You ready? We're going on a spiritual diet here. Listen to this. Are you ready? This is not a journey for those who expect love and bliss. Rather, it is for the hardy who have been tried in fire and have come to rest in a tough, immovable trust in that which lies beyond the known, beyond the self, beyond union, and even beyond love and trust itself. Now, it's interesting because NTI, when it talks about the empty shell, it asks us to let go of everything but the shell's casing, and it says that is trust. The shell is made of trust. In other words, it asks us to let go of everything but trust, and that's really what she's saying here. And there is no doubt in my mind that she is saying in her own words that this is only for people who want awakening more than anything else. If you want anything else, you will not succeed, right? And you have to be willing to trust the unknown, God, truth, whatever you want to call it, regardless. No matter what happens, no matter what occurs, no matter what you experience, right? And so this, again, would explain why awakening, again, she's talking about awakening to the first principle of God, to the absolute. And whenever we read teachers that talk about awakening to the absolute, they genuinely say awakening to that level is rare. When we hear about thousands of people awakening, they're talking about awakening to consciousness, the second principle of God. But when they start talking about awakening to the first principle of God, they say it's rare. They also say anyone can do it. The masters say both. It's rare and anyone can do it. So you have to ask, if it's rare and anyone can do it, you know, what's the gap there? And I think the gap is what she's describing right here. The gap is absolutely wanting that above anything else, regardless of anything else, and having that immovable trust in the unknown as you go through the process all of the way. I'll just read her words again. This is not a journey for those who expect love and bliss. And that doesn't mean that there isn't love and bliss at the end. It's just that if you expect love and bliss, you turn away from the trials. Right? You can't go through the hard spots because you want peace now. You want love now. You want bliss now. And that actually gets in your way. Right? Remember in the Course, Jesus said you go through the darkness to the light. And most people don't actually want to go through the darkness. They want to somehow skip around it. And as a result, they keep themselves on the outside of the gate. This is not a journey for those who expect love and bliss. Rather, it is for the hardy who have been tried in fire and have come to rest in a tough, immovable trust in that which lies beyond the known, beyond the self, beyond union, and even beyond love and trust itself. And if you really listen to that paragraph, you can see why few people awaken to the first principle of God. The truth is, we want it easier than it is. She says, I can only speculate about why so little has been said of this breakthrough, meaning the second awakening. She says, or perhaps, and this is my view, they have confused these two movements by failing to adequately distinguish between them. That is, to distinguish between a radical change of consciousness, which is the first awakening, from the consciousness of the ego to unitive consciousness. They fail to distinguish between a radical change of consciousness and the cessation of consciousness, between going between beyond the first lower ego self and later going beyond the higher true self. They've confused union with God and God beyond union. So in other words, most people like her before she had the second awakening, she only knew about the first awakening. And because that's all most people know about, and because they think that's it, there's no writing about continuing on to a second awakening, right? They just don't know. She says, my purpose then in writing this account is to help clarify the second movement, to make it more recognizable and to bring it to light. And in fact, she, you know, I'm skipping around a little bit, but she also says she won't be talking about how to awaken to consciousness, the unitive state. But she says there's lots of books out there about that, so I'm not going to do that. She says what she's going to do is talk about the second movement, from the time you awaken to the unitive state until you awaken to the absolute. That is the focus of these books. So that is the focus of what I'm going into now. She does say, and this is important for everyone to hear, if you don't listen to every word I say, listen to this. If you're gonna listen to this teaching, listen to this sentence, okay? No two will have the same experiences. That's very, very important, because she is going to describe every experience she went through. And if you expect to have the same experiences as her, then you may be thrown off because you're not. Also, some of her experiences may actually terrify you, right? So it's important to know these are her experiences. You will have your own experiences. And I assure you that if you go all the way to awakening, you will have experiences that terrify you too. I already have. So I know that to be a fact. I also know they're only terrifying us because in the moment we're terrified, we're believing our own imagination. So there's no danger. Okay? There's no danger. We're terrified as if there's danger. But we're sitting there imagining the danger, right? So there's no actual danger. Again, no two will have the same experiences. She says, it seems that the nature of this passage is a total state of unknowing, which, while it lent a certain beauty and air of mystery to its unfoldment, also lent a sense of bewilderment, which was responsible, I believe, for certain hardships that might have been avoided if some explanation had been forthcoming. In other words, what she's saying here is her awakening, her second awakening, was so difficult because she had no idea what was going on. And what she's hoping is that by writing these books, she can give us enough information that even though our experience is different from hers, we'll have enough understanding about what's going on that it'll give us a little more certainty or confidence as we go through. And this is why I often tell people things like, you know, when they're going through the I am bad, I say it's going to get worse before it gets better. I don't tell them that so that they'll stop. I tell them that so that they'll understand it's normal, right? For me, and apparently for her, if you have some understanding of what you're going through, it's easier. Hey, look, Regina Akers is in the room. Hey, Carrie, you're in as me. It's kind of funny. Anyway, So she's hoping that her book won't scare us so that we stop. That instead the attitude we'll take is, okay, she went through this and survived. This is normal. This is just what happens as you awaken, right? That's really the attitude she's hoping we'll take her story with. She says, I knew that if I did not record this transition as soon as possible, she wrote this, if I remember correctly, like she started writing this 4 days after her second awakening, but I could be a little bit off on that, but that's the way I remember it. We'll find out, I'm sure, later if that's true or not. She goes, I knew that if I did not record this transition as soon as possible, it would soon be forgotten. Because remember, now her mind is focused in a now moment of the unknown. So she had to write this stuff down quick, right? Kind of like you have to write down a dream quick, or what happens to the dream? You forget it, right? So if you want to remember the dream, you need to write it down quick. I knew that if I did not record this transition as soon as possible, it would soon be forgotten. Because one of the first lessons learned on this journey is that the passing of each experience leaves nothing in its wake, hardly a footprint, and certainly not a vivid memory. In a word, one learns to live without a past. And in fact, one learns to live without a future too, right? If you're focused on the current moment, the now unknown, there's no past, no future. She says, in conclusion, I must reemphasize that the following experiences do not belong to the first contemplative movement or the soul's establishment in a state of union with God. This movement, the first movement, is inevitably the exclusive concern of contemplative writers. Thus, it is only where these writers leave off that I propose to begin. Here now begins the journey beyond union, beyond self, beyond God, a journey into the silent and still regions of the unknown. And that's the conclusion of the introduction in this book. So I did not get to the introduction in this book, the second book, which I don't have as much to cover in the introduction, but there are a few points that she makes really well in this introduction that she didn't make in this one. So next week we'll begin with this, and we'll listen to those few more clarifying points before we dive into the books. All right. Thanks for coming to the narrow path, and I let go of the mic.